numbers from the Odessa American this Friday. Ector County total cases, both confirmed and probable, 7,261. Ector County negative, 27,130 out of 34,771 tested, with 380 pending, 121 deaths. Recovered, 5,719. Active, 1,421. There were no reports about ECISD daily cases today. Midland County, 5,843 confirmed, 100 deaths. The MISD dashboard still reports 330 confirmed cases, and Midland Memorial is still reporting 47 out of 50 COVID beds occupied. From the Texas Tribune, average new cases increased by 958 cases compared with the 7-day average a week ago. On November 5th, 8,332 new cases were reported. Hospitalizations increased by 367 patients compared with a week ago. As of November 5th, 5,954 Texans are hospitalized for the coronavirus. Average new deaths increased by 15 deaths compared with the 7-day average a week ago. On November 5th, 133 new deaths in Texas were reported. Here are coronavirus briefs from the Washington Post. Another day, another record shattered. The United States reported 116,707 new coronavirus infections Thursday, as 20 states saw their highest daily counts and the number of fatalities nationwide exceeded 1,000 for the third consecutive day. So far this month, 20 U.S. states have hit record high COVID-19 cases. There's been this sense of people giving up. Michael Fraser, chief executive of the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials, told the Post, "You had state leaders looking at the election and deciding it was not worth taking bold, unpopular moves against the virus that might save lives but hurt your side politically. There's been state officials debating whether to continue telling people to do things because they know many are not going to listen." Former Food and Drug Administration Commissioner Scott Gottlieb predicted that officials would avoid stay-at-home orders in favor of more targeted restrictions in areas suffering the most. In an interview with CNBC on Friday, he noted that Google's location data shows people have recently been voluntarily leaving their homes less, especially in the hard-hit Midwest. "You're going to see people pull back, and then policymakers are going to try to fit a framework around that," Gottlieb said. Now here's our pre-recorded report we have for you today. From NPR, CDC reports state officials' new coronavirus test was flawed, but released it anyway.
"We are also tracking the pandemic, where the United States remains the world leader in cases and deaths. This election week, the U.S. surpassed 100,000 cases per day for the first time. And today we have more of the story of how we got here. An NPR investigation has revealed news of a failure of coronavirus testing. Early in the pandemic, in February, a test designed by the Centers for Disease Control did not work, which set back U.S. efforts. Now an internal investigation from the CDC obtained by NPR shows the microbiologists who produced that test knew it was flawed and sent it to the nation's labs anyway." Here's NPR's Dina Temple-Rest.
The COVID tests arrived in New York City on a Friday in early February, when there were just a handful of confirmed cases in the United States.
"It was a little box with a few little tiny screw cap test tubes in it."
That's Jennifer Raikman. She's the director and assistant commissioner of the New York City Public Health Laboratory. And she was one of the first people to learn that the COVID-19 test the CDC sent to labs around the country actually didn't work. It became clear as soon as her lab technicians tried to verify the test.
"Well, the emails from the lab staff were saying, something looks not quite right, call us."
What jumped out at them? When the lab ran specimens that were supposed to be negative, the tests seemed to indicate those samples contained a low level of the coronavirus.
"It was truly an oh crap moment. Like, what are we going to do now? Everybody is waiting for us all over the city to have this test online. Everybody was holding on to this moment that we were going to have a test, and now we don't have it."
And they wouldn't have it turns out, until nearly a month later, in March, which meant public health officials were hobbled from the earliest days of the pandemic.
Health officials across the country reporting a shortage of tests despite promises from the federal government.
This comes amid growing criticism that a delay in testing may have compromised the nation's ability to detect cases.
The CDC lab appeared to have failed in a spectacular way. Though, as recently as July, the agency was still saying the test didn't have a problem. Here's CDC Director Robert Redfield.
When we did try to expand that test to give it to each of the local health departments, there was a manufacturing problem in one of the reagents that had to be corrected that took about 5 weeks.
But the agency's internal review suggests that isn't so. It determined that the scientists who built the test used the wrong quality control procedures. The review also found problems with the lab's quality standards and problems with the management of the lab more generally. The infectious diseases lab was run by a highly regarded scientist, Dr. Steven Lindstrom. He'd been an expert in influenza at the CDC for more than a decade and became director of the infectious diseases lab a couple of years ago. The CDC declined to make Lindstrom available for an interview and declined to comment for the story. But Kelly Robleski, director of infectious diseases at the Association of Public Health Laboratories, said she was surprised that Lindstrom's lab would be called out in a report for something basic like quality control. That hadn't been her experience with him.
I've done studies with Steve, and he's meticulous. And so the documentation failure was really surprising.
So that was one thing the CDC found, a problem in the way the lab was run. The second thing the review found was that right before the tests were going to be sent to hundreds of public labs, the lab ran a final check that showed the kits might not work a third of the time. But rather than pull the kits back, lab officials sent them out anyway. Kelly Robleski again.
The thing that hangs me up the most is probably the 33% and not recalling or not immediately going to remanufacture or something at that point. Because 33% is clearly a lot.
To ensure this never happens again, the CDC review has recommendations for change. It sets clear criteria that must be met before the kits can be sent out, rather than allowing lab directors to make a judgment call. An outside group must review all the CDC test kits before they go out. Steven Lindstrom, for his part, no longer runs the lab, and none of the same people who oversaw the making of that test are in charge now. New York's Rakeman says that month they lost was crucial.
The outcome and the response nationally as well as in New York City would have been different if we were able to have all the tools we needed in our toolbox earlier than we did.
Not having the CDC test, she said, was like building a house with just a saw and not a hammer. They needed a hammer, she said. Dina Temple-Raston, NPR News.
Now here are some articles. From CNN Health. Cough droplets can travel beyond 6 feet, a new simulation study suggests, by Jacqueline Howard. A new simulation study suggests that a person coughing can disperse droplets well beyond 6 feet, and that anyone shorter than the person coughing, such as children, might be at a greater risk of encountering the downward trajectory of those cough droplets. During the coronavirus pandemic, the dispersion of cough droplets has become of great interest among scientists. The new study, published on Tuesday in the journal Physics of Fluids, evaluates the risk of spreading the virus through cough droplets in the air under different tropical outdoor environments. Young children may be at greater risk compared to adults, based on the typical downward cough trajectory. Teenagers and short adults are advised to maintain a social distance greater than 2 meters from taller persons, the researcher wrote in the study. Surgical masks are known to be effective at trapping large droplets and therefore recommended for use as necessary. The researchers from Singapore's Agency of Science, Technology and Research used numerical models to simulate the trajectory of droplets expelled by a person who suddenly coughs outdoors with someone listening nearby. The researchers ran the simulation with different droplet sizes, air temperatures, relative humidity, wind speed, and varying distances between the cougher and the listener. The study suggests that at wind speeds of 2 meters per second, or about 4 miles per hour, the travel distances for droplets around the sizes of 100 micrometers and 1,000 micrometers can reach 21.6 feet and 4 feet, respectively, at 86 degrees Fahrenheit. For a 100 micrometer droplet, the researchers found that the travel distance increases from about 3 feet without wind to about 22 feet at a wind speed of about 6.7 miles per hour. The study has some limitations, including that the results are based on simulation models, not real-life experiments, and the effects of ambient temperature and humidity on the viability of the coronavirus remains unclear. This isn't the first time a model has suggested that a cough can travel farther than 6 feet. In May, separate research out of Cyprus that also published in the journal Physics of Fluids found that a light breeze could carry some droplets as far as 18 feet. And here's a story that, especially with the last few days, I think is very appropriate. I've been saving this story to read for a few days now. From the New York Times, is everybody doing okay? Let's ask social media. Researchers are looking at online behavior to gauge public mental health. The results aren't pretty. By Casey Schwartz, published October 12th. Which was the saddest day of them all? This is the question you may be asking yourself, surveying the wreckage of 2020 thus far. There are so many contenders to consider. Was it Thursday, March 12th, the day after Tom Hanks announced he was sick and the NBA announced it was canceled? Was it Monday, June 1st, the day that peaceful protesters were tear-gassed so that President Trump could comfortably stroll to his Bible-wielding photo op? Actually, it was neither. According to the Computational Story Lab of the University of Vermont. Instead, the lab offers this answer. Sunday, May 31st. That day was not only the saddest day of 2020 so far, it was also the saddest day recorded by the lab in the last 13 years, or at least the saddest day on Twitter. The researchers call it Hedometer. It is the invention of Chris Danforth and his partner Peter Dodds, both trained mathematicians and computer scientists and the co-directors of the lab. The Hedometer has been up and running for more than a decade now, measuring word choices across millions of tweets every day the world over to come up with a moving measure of well-being. In fact, the last time the New York Times checked in with the Hedometer team in 2015, the main finding to emerge was our tendency toward relentless positivity on social media. One of the happiest years on Twitter, at least for English, Dr. Danforth said recently with a note of rue. That result now seems an artifact from an ancient era. Since then, it has been a long decline. What has remained constant is this. Happiness is hard to know. It's hard to measure, he said. We don't have a lot of great data about how people are doing. The Computational Story Lab is part of a small but growing field of researchers who try to parse our national mental health through the prism of our online life. After all, never before have we had such an incredible stockpile of real-time data, what's known as our digital traces, to choose from. And never has that stockpile of information towered as high as it does now. In the summer of 2020, in the first months of the pandemic, Twitter reported a 34% increase in daily average user growth. Without our normal social life, as antidote and anchor, our social media now feels more like real life than ever before. Since 2008, the Hedometer has gathered a random 10% of all public tweets every day across a dozen languages. The tool then looks for words that have been ranked for their happy or sad connotation, counts them, and calculates a kind of national happiness average based on which words are dominating the discourse. On May 31st, the most commonly used words in the English language Twitter included terrorist, violence, and racist. This was about a week after George Floyd was killed near the start of the protests that would last all summer. Since the beginning of the pandemic, the Hedometer's sadness readings have set multiple records. This year, there was a full month, and we never see this, There was a full month of days that the hedometer was reading sadder than the Boston Marathon day, Dr. Danforth said. Our collective attention is very ephemeral, so it was really remarkable then that the instrument, for the first time, showed this sustained, depressed mood, and then it got even worse when the protest started. James Pennebaker, an intellectual founder of online language analysis and a social psychologist at the University of Texas at Austin, became interested in what our choice of words reveals about ourselves, our moods, our characters, exactly at the moment when the internet was first supplying such an enormous stockpile of text to draw from and to consider. These digital traces are markers that we're not aware of, but they leave marks that tell us the degree to which you are avoiding things, the degree to which you are connected to people, said Dr. Pennebaker, the author of The Secret Life of Pronouns, among other books. They are telling us that you are paying attention to the world. But Dr. Pennebaker said one of the challenges of this line of research is that language itself is always evolving, and algorithms are notoriously bad at discerning context. Take, for example, cursing. Swear words have changed in the last 10 years, he said, noting that now far from necessarily being an expression of anger, cursing can be either utterly casual or even positive, used to emphasize a point or express an enthusiasm. He is updating his electronic dictionaries accordingly. Munmun De Chowdhury, a professor in the School of Interactive Computing at Georgia Tech, is also examining digital data for insights into well-being. Dr. De Chowdhury's work over the years has focused not only on population studies, like the hedometer, but also on the individual. In 2013, she and colleagues found that by looking at new mothers on social media, they were able to help predict which ones might develop postpartum depression based on their posts before the birth of their babies. One of the most telling signs, the use of the first-person singular pronouns like I and me. If I'm constantly talking about me, it means that my attention has inward focus, Dr. De Chowdhury said. In the context of other markers, it can be a correlate of mental illness. This finding first emerged in the work of Dr. Pennebaker, but Dr. De Chowdhury said that the particular study was eye-opening for her. We were pleasantly surprised that there is so much signal in someone's social media feed that can help make these predictions, Dr. Chowdhury said. Using data from social media for the study of mental health also helps address the WEIRD problem, an acronym that describes how psychology research is often exclusively composed of subjects who are Western, educated, and from industrialized, rich, and democratic countries. Social media provides a huge benefit because historically most research on mental health has been self-reported, so people were given surveys, Dr. De Chowdhury said, and the people who were recruited were either college students or patients at a clinic. We're now able to look at a much more diverse variety of mental health experiences. Examining Twitter data during the first 2 months of the pandemic outbreak in the United States, Dr. De Chowdhury has been looking for signs of not just simple sadness, like the hedometer, but also anxiety, depression, stress, and suicidal thoughts. Unsurprisingly, she found that all these levels were significantly higher than during the same months of 2019. You may be wondering if Twitter is really a representative place to check the state of the general population's mental health. After all, many of its users tend to refer it by such nicknames as Hell Site and Sewer. Some studies have shown that frequent social media use is correlated with depression and anxiety. Can we really discern our national happiness based on this particular digital environment and the fraction of the population, 1 in 5 in 2019, that regularly use Twitter? Angela Zhao Wu thinks we cannot. Dr. Wu, an assistant professor of media, culture, and communication at NYU, argues that in the rush to embrace data, many researchers ignore the distorting effects of the platforms themselves. We know that Twitter's algorithms are designed to keep us hooked on our timelines, emotionally invested in the context we are presented with, coaxed toward remaining in a certain mental state. If social scientists then take your resulting state, after all these interventions that these platforms have worked on you, and derive from that a national mood, there's a huge part of the platform incitement that's embedded in the data, but it's not being identified, she said. Indeed, Johannes Eisenstadt, a computational social scientist at Stanford and a founder of the World Well-Being Project, concedes that the methods like the one he uses in his own lab are far from perfect. I would say it's about a C+, he said. It's not that accurate, but it's better than nothing. The closest we get to looking at national mental health otherwise is through surveys like the one Gallup performs. And so far, Gallup's findings are in line with the early findings of Dr. Eichenstadt, Dr. DeChaudhry, and the Hedometer team. According to Gallup, Americans reported the lowest rates of life satisfaction this year in over a decade, including during the 2008 recession. These statistics are consistent with more IRL observations in real life. For example, the experience of many therapists working long days on Zoom to help patients cope with the same crisis they themselves are going through. I have never been more exhausted at the end of the day than I am now, said Michael Garfinkel, a psychoanalyst in New York. Dr. Garfinkel notes that depression among his patients has noticeably increased since the pandemic began, but as well, even more broadly. Everyone is trying to estimate how everyone else is doing, because everyone is in a state of disorientation that keeps shifting, but not getting better. Our next piece is also from the New York Times, and it's an interesting insight into a person that is not only trying to recover from COVID, but also a very young person. At 12, she's a COVID long hauler. Although most young people recover quickly, doctors are seeing some children and teens with lingering fatigue and other chronic problems. By David Tuller, published October 22nd, updated October 23rd. In early March, when coronavirus testing was still scarce, Maggie Flannery, a Manhattan sixth grader, and both her parents fell ill with the symptoms of COVID-19. After 3 weeks, her parents recovered. Maggie also seemed to get better, but only briefly before suffering a relapse that left her debilitated. It felt like an elephant sitting on my chest, Maggie said. It was hard to take a deep breath. I was nauseous all the time. I didn't want to eat. I was very lightheaded when I stood up or even just lying down. She also experienced joint pain and severe fatigue. At first, specialists suggested Maggie's symptoms might be psychological, in part because she showed no sign of heart or lung damage. She also tested negative for both the coronavirus itself and for antibodies to it. But viral tests taken long after the initial infection are generally negative, and antibody tests are frequently inaccurate. They didn't know anything about long COVID at that point, said Amy Wilson, Maggie's mother. They said it was anxiety. I was pretty sure that wasn't true. Maggie's pediatrician, Dr. Amy DeMattia, has since confirmed the COVID-19 diagnosis based on the child's clinical history and the fact that both her parents tested positive for coronavirus antibodies. More than 7 months into the coronavirus pandemic, it has become increasingly apparent that many patients with both severe and mild illness do not fully recover. Weeks and months after exposure, these COVID long haulers, as they have been called, continue experiencing a range of symptoms, including exhaustion, dizziness, shortness of breath, and cognitive impairments. Children are generally at significantly less risk than older people for serious complications and death from COVID-19, but the long-term impacts of infection on them, if any, have been especially unclear. Although doctors recognize that a small number of children have suffered a rare inflammatory syndrome shortly after infection, there is little reliable information about how many who get COVID-19 have prolonged complaints like Maggie Flannery. That could change as the proportion of children who are infected rises. According to the American Academy of Pediatrics, children represented 10.9% of reported cases nationwide as of mid-October, up from just 2.2% in April. Dr. Richard Besser, a pediatrician and chief executive of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, which focuses on health policy, said parents can be reassured by the data on children's reduced overall risk, but he noted that much remains unknown about coronavirus infection and its medical consequences, including among children, and that continued vigilance is warranted. With schools reopening, we're likely to see more infections in children, he said. We need to make sure we're doing the studies to understand the short, medium, and long-term effects. To manage her condition, Maggie, who is 12, must limit her activities. Although she has been able to attend socially distanced in-person classes at her small private school on the Upper West Side, she no longer walks the 15 blocks there and back. She has trouble concentrating, so homework takes a lot longer. She has stopped attending online ballet classes. Before the pandemic, she went to 4 ballet classes a week. Some days are a lot better than others, said Maggie. If I do too much on the good days, I feel a lot worse on the next day or the next couple of days, and some days I can't do anything if it's a bad day. She has felt a slight improvement over time, she said. As with Maggie, 19-year-old Chris Willem and his parents got sick around the same time. In their case, it was in June when viral tests were more available. All three of them tested positive. Only Chris, a rising sophomore at Johns Hopkins and a member of the cross country and track and field teams, did not get better. Since he did not initially know about the possibility of chronic symptoms, Chris said he was confused and shocked about his condition. The first doctors he consulted told him the symptoms would fade, he said. For a while it was just, we need to wait a little bit longer. It will just get better with time, he said. Everyone was giving me this magic number, like the 12-week mark is when all your respiratory issues are supposed to go away. We hit that weeks ago and there's really not any improvement. Chris recently consulted with Dr. Peter Rowe, a professor of pediatrics at Johns Hopkins, who specializes in chronic and debilitating conditions like myalgic encephalomyelitis, chronic fatigue syndrome, which is often triggered by viral illness and has no approved drug treatments. Dr. Rowe determined that Chris has the heart racing condition known as postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, or POTS, which can occur after viral infections and limits the ability to carry out day-to-day activities. He had been capable of running 60 and 70 miles a week as a runner, said Dr. Rowe, adding that some of the symptoms and the really severe impairment that Chris and many other long haulers suffer from are characteristic of MECFS. Under Dr. Rowe's direction, Chris has been trying different medications in an effort to alleviate the symptoms. In Baltimore, the Kennedy Krieger Institute, a treatment facility for children with neurological and other chronic disabilities, is offering multidisciplinary services for those under 21 who continue to experience challenges after COVID-19. So far, the Institute has seen only one patient, said Dr. Melissa Travato, the Institute's interim medical director of rehabilitation. With infections on the rise, Dr. Travato said she thought it was quite possible the clinic will see more patients with persistent symptoms in the coming months. Because of the perception that COVID-19 is rare in kids, she said parents might not associate a mild illness and subsequent effects, like a loss of energy, with the coronavirus. It might take more time for a family to pick up on it, she said. From a pediatric perspective, there probably is more than we're going to find out as more children with prolonged symptoms come forward and get seen. Zaya McKinney-Taylor, a dancer and birth doula in Atlanta, never doubted that her 14-year-old daughter, Ava, was suffering from the lingering effects of COVID-19, even though she tested negative for both the virus and antibodies. Before Ava got sick in March, said Ms. McKinney-Taylor, she was a super energetic kid who took dancing and Aikido lessons 5 days a week. That has changed. She has never really gotten her energy back. She is always sleeping and napping, she said. Ava herself rejected as ridiculous the suggestion from some doctors that her exhaustion might be related to the stresses of life under quarantine. Like, you're just not getting to do your normal activities, she said. I'm a very active person. This couldn't just be, oh, I'm sad that my friends are gone. Like many other families confronting similar uncertainties, Ms. McKinney-Taylor and her daughter are feeling their way forward amid the unknowns of the disease. It is very scary as a parent to not know how to prepare yourself and protect your child, other than read lots of articles and be on a Slack group, she said, referring to the Body Politic COVID-19 online support community. Under the circumstances, Ava said it can be tough to maintain her spirits. It's a little hard to have hope right now, she said. We don't know if this will be a lifelong thing, if this will last a year or 2 years or 5 years, so the future is not looking too bright for me personally. And now I'm going to read to you an article from the Washington Post, and it's another piece related to the holidays. As holidays near, the coronavirus is spreading rapidly, putting families in a quandary about celebrations and travel. By Joel Achenbach. Published October 25th. Barbara Alexander's Christmas tradition is to drive 2.5 hours to the 40-acre farm her parents bought 7 decades ago in southeastern North Carolina. It's a big affair. 35 family members arrive by Christmas Eve. This year, she is thinking, wait till next year. She'll stay home in Durham, North Carolina, with her husband, teenage son, and 96-year-old mother, Marble Dudley. As a physician and the president-elect of the Infectious Diseases Society of America, Alexander is fully aware of the risks of holiday gatherings in the middle of a pandemic and the vulnerability of her non-agenarian mother. COVID doesn't care that it's a holiday, and unfortunately, COVID is on the rise across the nation, she said. Now is not the time to let our guard down and say, it's the holiday and let's be merry. I think we need to maintain our vigilance here. The coronavirus pandemic numbers have been going in the wrong direction for more than a month, topping 80,000 newly confirmed infections daily across the country, with hospitalizations rising in more than 36 states and deaths creeping upward. Now the United States is barreling toward another inflection point, a holiday season dictated by the calendar and demanded by tradition. The anticipated surge in interstate travel, family gatherings, and indoor socializing is expected to facilitate the spread of COVID-19, the disease caused by the novel coronavirus. This isn't like the run-up to Memorial Day or Independence Day. Barbecues outdoors or pool parties aren't on the itinerary of many people. The fall and winter holidays are homey by nature. Respiratory viruses thrive in dry, warm, indoor conditions in which people crowd together. The statistical peak of flu season typically comes close on the heels of Christmas and New Year's. Colder weather is already driving people indoors. The government's top doctors have said they believe the recent national spike in infections has largely been driven by household transmission. Super spreader events have gotten a lot of attention, but it's the prosaic meals with family and friends that are driving up caseloads. This trend presents people with difficult individual choices, and those choices carry societal consequences. Epidemiologists look at the broad effect of a contagion, not simply the effects on individuals. Thanksgiving, for example, is an extremely busy travel period in America. The coronavirus exploits travelers to spread in places where it had been sparse or absent. I am nervous about Thanksgiving, said Andrew Neumer, an epidemiologist at the University of California at Irvine. I'm nervous because I know what happens when you multiply the risk by millions of households. The scientists are not telling people to cancel their holiday plans necessarily, but they are urging people to think of alternative ways to celebrate. They do not say it explicitly, but they are encouraging a kind of rationing of togetherness. This is not the cold. This is not the flu. This is much worse. People are dying. Our well-being as a country depends on us getting this thing under control, Alexander said. Public health officials doubt an elegant way exists to finesse the 2020 pandemic-shrouded holidays with minimal disruption. For example, by working through a checklist of best practices that include timely testing, scrupulous social distancing, and disciplined mask wearing. Instead, people will need to make serious adjustments as they calculate the risks and rewards of holiday gatherings. There's no easy answer here. Just like with everything else, it's not about safe or unsafe. It's about figuring out how to balance various risks and keeping risks as low as possible, Harvard epidemiologist Julia Marcus said. This is not a one-size-fits-all issue, said Anthony S. Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. It depends on what risk you want to take. Fauci then summed up the fundamental conundrum. It is difficult, if not impossible, to quantify what that risk is. Since the start of the pandemic in the United States, scientific uncertainties and mixed messaging from government leaders have left people in the position of playing amateur epidemiologist, forced to calculate the relative hazards of different activities and the benefits of specific precautions. People have to estimate their vulnerabilities and that of their friends and relatives, based on age, underlying health conditions, occupational exposures, access to health care, and the level of coronavirus transmission in their community and in the places where their holiday guests are coming from. Donald Milton, a University of Maryland professor of environmental health, said one of his medical colleagues decided to cancel the usual family plans for Thanksgiving. He's buying a very small turkey. Or maybe it's a hen, or maybe it's just a chicken breast. People have had to make their holiday calculations, even as the scientists and doctors have adjusted their own ideas and guidance. On Wednesday, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention changed the definition of what close contact with an infected person means. It's now 15 minutes of cumulative exposure within 6 feet within a 24-hour period, instead of 15 consecutive minutes. Milton said he and his wife will have a limited family gathering that relies in part on air filters to keep the indoor air as clean as possible. He is an expert on aerosols and has contended the coronavirus can be transmitted at distances much greater than the 6 feet standard widely used in the guidance about physical distancing. There is no magic line at 6 feet. 6 feet is a nice handy rule. It doesn't mean you're unsafe on one side of the line and safe on the other side, Milton said. There remains debate about whether aerosol transmission is a major or minor driver of the pandemic. What's certain is that other than completely isolating oneself, there is no way to drive the risk to zero. Even as many experts warn about the risks, there's another factor people must take into account: the psychological benefits of being with family and friends. Fauci said he respects the decisions of people who choose to get together, even if some family members have elevated risk factors. There are some families that are so frustrated with not seeing each other for so long, they're going to say, "Hey, I'm going to take the risk. My mental health of seeing my children or grandchildren is so important to me that I'm going to take the risk. I have no problem with that if that's what people want to do," Fauci said. But they need to realize there is a risk. Fauci has revealed that his family will not be getting together for Thanksgiving because at age 79, he's at an elevated risk for a severe outcome from COVID-19. His three adult daughters would have had to fly to and from Washington to come home, potentially becoming exposed in transit, and the family agreed the risk wasn't worth it. Marcus has been outspoken on the need for public health officials to offer people practical guidance that goes beyond prohibitions and various forms of scolding. She has criticized the news media, for example, for beach shaming, running photographs and videos of people having fun at the beach, even though that is a relatively low-risk environment if people maintain social distancing. You can't just tell people no. It doesn't work for HIV. It doesn't work for pregnancy. It doesn't work for substance use. It doesn't work for any other area of public health, Marcus said. We want to help people find the lowest risk place they can be in their lives that's healthy and sustainable for them. If you've reduced the risk to zero, you've probably compromised your health in other ways. So this is advanced math for everyone. A make-your-own algorithm challenge. The days of getting darker quickly, and the holidays are looming larger. The next big hurdle is the quasi-holiday of Halloween, which is not only a favorite of children, but a favorite party night for young adults, heavily promoted by commercial interests. Start with the kids. Is it safe to trick-or-treat? That's potentially a perfect way to spread the virus, said Emmanuel Chip Walter, chief medical officer of the Duke Human Vaccine Institute. But he said he understands many people will feel compelled to do it anyway, and he suggested that they move in small groups and use hand sanitizer for when the children reach into a bowl to retrieve candy. He suggested that people could leave candy at the edge of the property in individually wrapped bags, realizing that little kids might grab them all. Without an approved vaccine and with limited therapeutics to combat the coronavirus, the medical community is counting on the public to use common sense. Avoid buffets, potlucks, or other self-serve options, warned a news release Wednesday from the Infectious Diseases Society of America. Many families may hope timely testing will solve the problem of people converging from distant points. But some experts say testing won't solve all the holiday issues. The most sensitive tests, the PCR genetic tests, do not typically provide a result for several days. The rapid response antigen tests are usually faster, but they aren't as sensitive and can miss some infections. Timing is everything. A person who is exposed in transit, say on an airplane or in an airport, probably would not immediately develop an infection that could be detected by a test, Walter noted. Somebody may have been exposed and may not yet have a totally developed infection, Walter said. Tests, Walter said, can be reassuring, but potentially falsely reassuring. I wouldn't put all my stock in testing. Leanna Wren, the former Baltimore Health Commissioner and a contributing columnist to the Post, believes a combination of quarantining, testing, and precautions during travel could lower the risk for someone traveling home for the holidays from some distant location. The quarantining should last 14 days before a rapid response test, which would ideally be just before the holiday, for example, the Wednesday night before Thanksgiving. But the very first thing people should do is talk through the issue and decide on a policy of risk tolerance. This is the year to say, no thank you, we cannot participate because we cannot subject ourselves to this level of risk, Wynn said. Everyone needs to define their limits, and that needs to be respected. And that may include families not being able to see one another this winter. The CDC on Monday issued official guidance on holiday celebrations, reminding people that the safest thing to do is stay home, sticking with people already in the household. If you get together with other people, limit the numbers and the duration of the event. Outdoors is better. Masks are essential, as is 6 feet of physical distancing and good hand hygiene. But there are limits to risk reduction. A person can't eat Thanksgiving dinner, drink holiday eggnog, or ring in the new year with champagne while wearing a mask. The question of who gets to participate is also tricky. The CDC says people with increased risk from the coronavirus should not attend in-person holiday gatherings. The CDC defines that as older adults and those with chronic medical conditions. Who are older adults? The CDC simply states, accurately, that risk increases with age, noting that people in their 50s have a greater risk than people in their 40s, and people in their 60s and 70s a greater risk than people in their 50s. People older than 85 are at greatest risk. There are more than 100 million people in America over age 50. There are millions more who are younger but have chronic conditions such as obesity and diabetes. Taken literally, the CDC guidance implies that a very large percentage of the American population should not join friends and family at the holiday table. This is a confounding virus. It is not predictable in its effects. Even very elderly people usually recover from the coronavirus. Although young people are much less likely to have a severe illness, it's not impossible. A severe outcome from COVID-19 is thus, for most people, a low probability but high consequence event, the threat of which can't be perfectly estimated. Fauci said he isn't trying to ruin everyone's holiday season. "I don't want to come across as the Grinch that stole Thanksgiving," Fauci said, but added, "it is something that people need to be concerned about." Alexander urges everyone to think long-term and imagine a better holiday season next year. "We really need the public thinking about the larger good. In this case, it's the health of the nation," she said. "The holiday season is going to be different. It just is. It's not what I want. But this is the pandemic we've been handed, so we're going to have to celebrate differently." And now here's our final piece today from CNN Business. Some grocery stores are limiting toilet paper and disinfecting wipe purchases again, by Nathaniel Meyerson. Several leading grocery chains are reimposing limits on key items, such as toilet paper, paper towels, and disinfecting wipes, hoping to keep their shelves stocked and prevent shoppers from hoarding, as they did when the pandemic began in the spring. At Kroger, customers can purchase a maximum of 2 items when it comes to products like bath tissue, paper towels, disinfecting wipes, and hand soap. A spokesperson said in an email that the limits began earlier this week and apply in stores and online. Christopher Brand, a spokesperson for Giant, a grocery chain in the Northeast, said that the company was seeing little evidence of stockpiling and there is no need to create panic. But since the supply chain remains challenged, Giant began last week putting a limit of 1 on purchases of larger toilet paper and paper towel sizes, and 4 on smaller toilet paper and paper towel sizes. HEB in Texas has implemented similar policies in recent weeks. Some HEB stores have instituted limits of 2 on purchases of disinfecting and antibacterial sprays, while other stores have limited toilet paper and paper towels to 2. The 3 companies say supply chains for securing these items are still strained. Around 19% of paper products, such as toilet paper and paper towels, and 16% of household cleaning products, were out of stock during the week ending November 1st, according to data from market research firm IRI. The moves come as the United States reported the largest number of new coronavirus infections Thursday, at least 108,174, according to Johns Hopkins University. The 5 highest daily totals of coronavirus cases since the pandemic began have happened in the last week. Meanwhile, nearly 60% of shoppers say they plan to stock up again as winter approaches, according to a survey of 1,000 shoppers by market research firm Inmar Intelligence, conducted during the week of October 14th. In California, Raley's supermarket says it's not experiencing a run on paper products, but it's preparing to respond if that happens. "We will continue to monitor stockpiling behavior closely and possibly re-implement limits accordingly in the upcoming weeks," Paul Gianetto, Senior Vice President of Sales and Merchandising, said in an email. And that's your coronavirus update for this Friday, November 6th, 2020. For from the Recording Library of West Texas. I'm Michael. Coming up at 2 o'clock, national news with USA Today. And then at 3, we'll bring you the local news. Here are a few of those articles that our volunteers are reading today. From the Midland Reporter-Telegram, Galindo contesting MISD District 1 race. Fuller and Booker talk about election and runoff. Feast of Sharing continues through deliveries. From the Odessa American, Odessa could see restrictions. Rate is at highest point, officials say. ECISD concern rises with COVID cases. And then we're going to read from the Odessa American today a national Associated Press story, which we rarely read those. We focus on local. But this is a very interesting story about two blind brothers who become, in capital letters, two blind brothers for a cause. Each of the brothers have a rare degenerative eye disorder. And so they've dedicated their lives and their livelihoods to raising money for a cure. So we'll bring you that story as well again in the Odessa American part of our local newspaper broadcast today. At 6 o'clock, more of the national news from the Wall Street Journal. And then remember, on Fridays, we have the On the Lighter Side program with lots of humorous readings. That's kind of a nice way, especially this week, a nice way to just relax and listen to something fun instead. And I also, by the way, have to apologize. You may have heard my cat in the background as we read today because he's been laying on the desk here. But again, thank you very much for listening, and we will be back on Monday afternoon at 1. We're going to leave you with a song today, as we always do on Fridays. I haven't selected one from the Great American Songbook in quite a while, so that's what I've got for you today. It's Ella Fitzgerald and Duke Ellington. I'm beginning to see the light. Stay safe and have a great weekend.
I never cared much for moonlit skies. I never winked back at fireflies. But now that the stars are in your eyes, I'm beginning to see the light. I never went in for afterglow or candlelight on the mistletoe. But now when you turn the lamp down low, I'm beginning to see the light. Used to ramble through the park, shadow boxing in the dark. Then you came and caused a spark. That's a four alarm fire now. I never made love by lantern shine. I never saw rainbows in my wine. But now that your lips are burning mine, I'm beginning to see the light. I never cared much for moonlit skies. I never winked back at fireflies. But now that the stars are in your eyes, I'm beginning to see the light. I never went in for afterglow or candlelight on the mistletoe. But now when you turn the lamp down low, I'm beginning to see the light. Used to ramble through the park, shadow boxing in the dark. Then you came and caused a spark. That's a four alarm fire now. I never make love by lantern shine. Some rainbows in my wine. But now that your lips are burning mine, I'm beginning to see the light. Now that the stars are in your eyes, I'm beginning to see the light. To see the light. Used to ramble through the park, shadow boxing in the dark. Then you came and caused a spark. That's a four alarm fire now. Now that your lips are
beginning to see the light. I'm beginning to see the light. Now that your lips are burning mine, I'm beginning to see.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today, followed by the Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American at 3.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas Community Update.
The Humane Society of Odessa, 7012 Mockingbird Lane, is offering curbside adoptions, vaccines, warmer, and more. Shelter hours are from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Monday through Saturday. Only one person is allowed in the office and kennels at this time. For applications, vaccine, or additional information, call 381-5503 or 257-4311 or email shelter@odessahumanesociety.org. To see current pets available or to private message the shelter, visit www.facebook.com/Humane Society of Odessa.
Here's something you don't hear on the radio every day. Someone who can't see. I am totally blind, and I go through periods where I'm unable to sleep at night and feel like I'm constantly running but can never quite catch up. But this isn't a sleep problem. It's something called non-24-hour disorder. Learn about non-24 by visiting learnmorenon24.com or calling 855-856-2424.
This week on the Recording Library of West Texas Radio's Saturday Night Movie, Sandra Bullock stars in The Blind Side.
I'm not cutting, I'm just asking. Let me tell you something, all right? We have been sitting around here for over an hour, and when I look around, all I see are people shooting the bull and drinking coffee.
How can I help you?
Oh, he was first.
No, you go ahead. I think I want to hear this.
Me too.
You're right.
Excuse me? You're right? How'd those words taste coming out of your mouth?
Like vinegar.
Who is that, SJ?
Big Mike. He goes to high school here.
What is he wearing? It's below freezing.
Do you have any place to stay tonight? Don't you dare lie to me.
Was this a bad idea?
What's the big deal? It's just for one night. It is just for one night, right? Yeah.
Tell me just one thing I should know about you.
Well, I'd like to be called Big Mike.
Leah, is this another one of your charities?
We need to find out more about his past.
He's been enrolled in 7 different institutions. His grade point average begins with 0.
He needs to do better in school.
I'd love to work with him.
This is mine?
Yes, sir.
Never had one before.
What, a room to yourself?
A bed.
Michael's grades have improved enough that he can go out for spring football.
How's he doing?
I haven't quite gotten the hang of it yet.
It's all real nice what you're doing, but don't be surprised if one day you wake up and he gone.
I heard you got your new mama now.
She's fine, too.
Michael was here.
Tell him to sleep with one eye open.
You threaten my son. You threaten me.
Sandra Bullock.
We're in the middle of practice, Leanne.
You can thank me later. His team is your family, Michael. You have to protect him. Tony here is your quarterback. You protect his blind side. When you look at him, you think of me.
Yes, ma'am.
SJ, you're going to want to get this.
Mike's the best left tackle I've seen in years.
You're changing that boy's life.
No, he's changing mine.
The Blind Side.
I said you could thank me later. It's later, Bert.
Quentin Aaron, Sandra Bullock, and Tim McGraw star in the audio-described The Blind Side, Saturday night at 7 on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 76 and clear. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the upper 50s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the low 70s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the upper 50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 2 p.m.
Hello, this is Melanie, and I'm reading articles from today's USA Today. That would be Friday, November 6th, 2020. Starting with the money section, under the money line column, couple of items. Market rallies as stocks ride post-election wave. Stocks rallied.